Shall we make a start? Welcome to this debate. My name's Tom Bentley, I'm Director of Demos, and we're very pleased to be holding the event in conjunction with the Centre for Global Governance here. We've got an early apology from Mary Calder, who is on her way and hopefully will be here in a few minutes, but has been stuck in traffic. But we can get started and she'll join us. This event and this discussion, and I hope that it will be a lively and kind of broad-ranging discussion involving many of you, arises from a Demos publication called The Moral Universe, which we began commissioning some 18 months ago, but whose themes have become steadily more prominent and I think probably more important in the last 4 or 5 months, and particularly since September last year. And so the title of the debate or the discussion is Global Morality, the New Ideology, is really a starting point for a discussion of globalization and its discontents, the issues of international legitimacy and particularly the uses of violence and the proper conduct of warfare, but also perhaps a more diffuse and difficult question underlying those things, which is about the way in which moral values are changing and about their proper place in political decision-making and conflict. And in a sense, the starting point for that title is the fact that particularly since September the 11th, politicians have been quite quick and quite direct in using the language of good and evil to analyze, to describe, to justify their actions on the political stage, both domestically and especially internationally. So I'm very pleased that we've got the panel of speakers that we have. They're all highly distinguished and have important things to bring. They're all contributors to the collection, which, by the way, is also available outside if you want to have a look at it in more detail. They are John Gray, Professor of European Thought here at the LSE, Joan Smith, who's an independent author and newspaper columnist, and wrote in particular a book called Moralities, published early last year, which I can heavily recommend, and Robert Cooper, who's a senior member of the Diplomatic Service, works for the Foreign Office, who he apologises has to leave early because of his involvement in Mohammed Karzai's visit to London. Each speaker is going to speak for about 10 minutes. Hopefully Mary will have arrived by the time we get to the end of the third contribution, if not before, and then we'll have an open discussion until about 7:30. So we'll start with John. Over to you.
Thank you very much. I will begin by focusing on what I think should be one of our central concerns, which is conflict and the ways in which the conflicts which are currently happening in the world should impact on our moral thinking. And this is intended, in a sense, as a pointer to my conclusion, which is that I think a lot of moral thought, as applied to politics, has evaded conflict, has tended to suppress or gloss over conflict, or to rest on the pious hope that conflicts can always be reconciled or somehow transcended. I don't think that's true. But before I say why, in order to show you how I get to that conclusion, I want to just make a couple of remarks on what's new in the types of conflict we're experiencing in the world post-September the 11th. What I take to be one of the most important features of the conflict that's currently underway is that it's a new type of war. I think it is war, not just police action against forms of illegal behavior, in that it's not solely or even primarily between states, although, of course, states are very heavily involved in it. One of the protagonists to this new type of war is not only not a state, but is not directed or controlled or the instrument of any state. And one can even go further and say that one of the features of this war is that it's points of highest intensity of conflict have been in areas of the world where states have collapsed or corroded almost to the point of non-existence. Not only Afghanistan, but also places like Chechnya and parts of the Balkans. And this brings out one very important feature of our present situation, which is that the world is littered with collapsed or failed or deeply corroded states. That in itself is not new. It's not state failure or state collapse is not new. What is new is the combination of state failure and state collapse in many parts of the world with globalization. In other words, what's new is the conjunction of regions of the world being semi or largely anarchic in that there's no state, the state has substantially lost its leverage over the control of organized violence. It's the conjunction of that with global media of communication and, at least to a higher degree in the past, global mobility of people. Not, of course, of emigration on a large scale, because that's severely controlled, but at any rate of people involved in various types of military and political conflict are dispersed right throughout the world in a way that they weren't before. So one thing I draw your attention to is this conjunction of two things, both of which, it seems to me, were unanticipated up to the mid-90s, and even unanticipated up to September the 11th. What was unanticipated is that the period of globalization would be a period of weak states in large parts of the world and collapsed states in some parts of the world. That wasn't anticipated. What was still less anticipated was that new types of conflict would emerge in which organizations, sometimes strategically or tactically for periods of time based in collapsed states or regions where the states had collapsed, would use the technologies and liberties which go with globalization in order to wage a new kind of war. Now, what do I conclude from this situation? And I warn you in advance that there'll be absolutely nothing here of comfort or consolation. The first thing, I think, there are three things, and then I'll finish. There are three lessons I take from this new type of conflict. The first is that the obsessional hostility to the state, which has been a feature of liberal thought throughout the 20th century, should be abandoned. It's no longer appropriate. It was true in the 20th century that the major crimes against humanity were committed by states, most of them. Not only the two world wars, the Holocaust, the Gulag, the major assaults on human freedom and human dignity, at least the largest and most terrible ones, were committed by states. It's no longer true, it seems to me. Even before the end of the 20th century, some of the major violations of human rights weren't committed by states, but occurred in countries where there were no states, in kind of political vacuums. The last big genocide, I suppose, or semi-genocidal conflict in Rwanda, wasn't committed by states. Nearly 2 million people were killed. It was committed by irregular militias against a background deformed by colonialism, but nonetheless it was not committed by a state. And in many parts of the world, the violence which is done to people, the exploitation they suffer, the insecurity they live in, has more in common with anarchy than it does with tyranny. I think that's very, very important, that we need to think afresh about the state and no longer see it as the enemy of freedom. The second thing is that strong modern states exist side by side with failed states or pre-modern states or collapsed states or zones of anarchy, and that's even true in Europe. Albania, Kosovo, Bosnia, Georgia, large parts of Europe actually don't contain modern states. They contain ruins of states, fragmented states, collapsed states. And I think one of the motives or explanations of the new defensive imperialism which has emerged, with imperial-type protectorates emerging in Europe and elsewhere in the world, is the fact that there are zones of the world in which not only is there no state, but it's going to be a very long haul to develop one which is really robust and self-sustaining. So strong modern states exist side by side with zones of anarchy and collapsed states. And this leads indirectly to my third point, but before I mention, I'd say that strong states seem to me the strong states that remain in the world are the key actors now. The key actors are certainly not transnational organizations. To my mind, they've been comprehensively marginalized. They have some significance as giving legitimacy to actions. They have some significance in mediating and in being areas of diplomacy and so forth. But the idea that they can supplant or displace or obstruct the determined action of strong sovereign states is just an illusion. I think we can see that now unfolding under our eyes. And indeed, strong states are seeking to become stronger. And this leads me to my third lesson, which is that the boundaries between domestic and foreign policy are being blurred. How are they being blurred? Well, any debates we may have about the balance to be struck between civil liberties and anti-terrorist legislation is an example, firstly, of the way in which strong states are seeking more powers of surveillance and control in order to protect their citizens from terrorist-originated insecurity, but also because that illustrates the blurring of the boundaries between domestic and foreign policy. What's my final conclusion from this? Well, my final conclusion is that these types of conflict don't allow the luxury of clean hands. That's to say, if you are engaged either in a military conflict or even in domestic political argumentation about civil liberties and terrorism and the conflict between the two, it seems to me that the first precondition of good moral thinking on it is honesty, is truthfulness, veracity, in the sense that you acknowledge that these are conflicts involving vital goods and that any resolution of the conflict in any future that we can foresee will involve serious and sometimes deeply humanly damaging loss. That the idea that there is some way out of these conflicts for us now that would be cost-free, that if only there are enough people of goodwill in the right places, that these conflicts would somehow evaporate or go away. I think that's the worst and most disabling illusion, not only because it means that the conflicts aren't coped with, it actually means that liberal societies are continuing to indulge themselves in the notion that they can reconcile deep-seated and often intractable disorders, which what we should be trying to do actually is not to reconcile, but to contain them, to negotiate them, to make their effects on human well-being less damaging, to try and use some of the conflicts as opportunities, but never to think that these deep political and military conflicts can be prosecuted without profound wrongs being committed, without, in other words, dirty hands. So if you wanted a kind of summary of what I'm saying, it's a plea for dirty hands.
Thank you very much. Joan.
When I was asked to come and take part in this debate, the working title of the meeting was, "Is Global Morality the New Ideology?" And I'm going to resist the temptation by starting flippantly and saying, I hope so. But what I will say is that I think it's a very pleasing thing that morality is now being talked about by the left and the centre-left, instead of accepting the popular assumption that the language of morality is somehow the province of the right. That morality, the old morality, concerned itself above all with the regulation of private life, along lines decreed by some supernatural authority, and it did a very good job of making a lot of people miserable. I'm often struck by the thought that I would not like to have been a woman or a gay man living even 50 years ago, when the word immoral was applied almost exclusively to people whose sexual acts fell outside heterosexual marriage. I once had a vigorous exchange of views on Radio 4 with Kenneth Minogue, who compared General Pinochet to Stalin and Pol Pot, but refused to go as far as describing him as immoral. It's true that Pinochet seems to be an exemplary husband and father and a devout Catholic, but he is also a mass murderer. My reason for taking this as my starting point is that I want to challenge the notion that religion has any monopoly at all on morality. I'm always amused by letters in the Daily Telegraph, there was one only last week, which deplore contemporary society and ask how you can have morality without God. I'm not going to claim it's easy, but secular morality has the advantage of having to argue out and establish principles rather than accepting an arbitrary set of supposedly divine commands. That proposition would, I suspect, be accepted by many of the contributors to the Demos pamphlet, whose publication is the occasion for this debate. and it's a welcome development at a time when the need for a new moral order is at last being seen as one of the most urgent priorities we need to address. This is particularly true after September the 11th, but it was happening before that. Tony Blair speaks the language of morality more frankly than any British Prime Minister in my lifetime. It's almost 3 years since he made a speech in Chicago, setting out the moral imperative to fight wars in situations where there's no obvious national interest. His speech at last year's Labour Party conference developed these themes, setting out a hugely ambitious moral agenda that startled and polarised his audience. I was in Brighton that evening, and I heard the speech described over and over again as Gladstonian, which was meant, rather to my surprise, as a compliment. Some sections of the centre-left welcomed the speech for its moral vision, a reaction summed up rather reductively by a Mirror headline claiming that the Prime Minister was going to save the world. I think he may have taken that too seriously. But it also raised all sorts of problems, not least the question of how to avoid the kind of Western intervention the Prime Minister envisions being seen as a new form of Western imperialism. The only way this can be done, if you accept, as I do, that it should be done, is if it happens in accordance with a framework of values whose guiding principles are acceptable to a constituency much wider than his supporters in this country. And the most striking thing about Blair's speech for me, as a lifelong secularist, was its exclusivity. His moral universe is composed of Christians, Muslims, Hindus, and followers of Judaism, all of whom he mentioned in the speech, but it has very little place for atheists, agnostics, and the many millions of people throughout the world whose outlook is wholly secular. This is, by the way, one of the problems I have with Sam Huntington's Clash of Civilizations thesis, which reduces extraordinarily diverse cultures to monoliths defined by old religious adherences. I'm not and never have been a Christian, just as many, if not most, of my Arab friends are entirely secular. Religion is only one strand in the way human beings construct their identity, and frequently a very divisive one. It actively encourages exclusivity, encouraging people to think of in terms of their difference from the rest of humanity, rather than that we all have in common. What we urgently need today is a framework of values that encourages us to recognize our responsibility to people on the other side of the world, not because we share an ethnicity or a religious faith, but because we recognize our common humanity. It's because of that divisive tendency in religions that I think the most urgent task facing us is to ensure that that framework is based on secular values. What I advocate in my book, Moralities, and I already see happening in some democracies, is a shift away from the kind of collective and coercive moral structure associated with religions to one that combines modern individualism with a human rights framework. Most of the great social movements of the last four decades, from feminism to gay rights and green politics, have shared a common project of empowering marginalized individuals, a project I've described in the book as a democratization of morality. This is not an easy case to argue in societies like ours, where a kind of narcissistic individualism is continually on display, creating a selfish cult of celebrity that is the antithesis of the values I'm advocating. But the fact that the public face of individualism is so repellent should not obscure the liberating effect of that project, which has been to lift the burden of shame and anxiety that was the lot of anyone who did not conform, particularly women and gay men. And that democratic morality, through its concern with liberating the individual, logically requires each and every one of us to recognize the rights of other individuals. Condorcet made this point more than two centuries ago, and I'll quote him at the risk of revealing that my ideas are drawn from the much maligned Enlightenment. He said, "Either no member of the human race has real rights, or else all have the same. He who votes against the rights of another, whatever his religion, colour, or sex, thereby abjures his own." That idea is implicit in many of the statements of human rights which are drawn up in the last century, from the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights to our own Human Rights Act, which came into force less than 18 months ago. One of the strengths of the Universal Declaration, at a moment when there is a great deal of suspicion of a resurgence of Western imperialism, is that its authors came from many cultures. And I think that these documents, which recognize both the rights of individuals and their responsibility to other people, are the best basis we have for a morality that reaches across to traditional divisions. Indeed, their force becomes apparent when you apply them to aspects of the international crisis we've all been living through since September the 11th. A secular morality based on human rights would not permit the kind of treatment we have seen meted out by the Americans to prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, whose purpose appears to be maximum humiliation of a defeated enemy. Nor would it allow any nation, no matter how powerful, to wage wars in a way that protects its own combatants at the cost of civilian carnage on the ground, which is a subject that Mary has had a great deal to say about. Above all, it would challenge the collusion of democratic countries with oppressive regimes in order to secure the freedom and prosperity of their own middle classes, which has been the ultimately disastrous policy followed by the United States since the Second World War. It is those double standards and the failure to ask questions about the West's relationship with absolute monarchies like Saudi Arabia, which are the source of most of our urgent problems. I wrote Moralities before September the 11th, but those terrible events have left me even more convinced of the need for a secular morality based on the notion of universal human rights. I don't mind if people want to classify it as an ideology, though it does seem to me that the accusation that it's a new religion is profoundly misconceived. Unlike religions, human rights provide an ethical framework which seeks to protect the rights of individuals, regardless of race and gender, while also recognizing the responsibility to the wider community. That balance may not be easy to achieve, but I believe it's essential if there's to be any chance of making the world a safer and fairer place.
Thank you very much. Mary.
Well, like Joan, I wrote my piece for this pamphlet before September the 11th. And the question that really occurs to me is whether the title is still valid. I noticed that Robert Cooper, in his article, points out that in the last 10 years, values have become much more important in international affairs compared with the traditional realpolitik of states. And I really ask myself whether that is still true after September the 11th, and in a way, that's what I want to talk about. I wish it were true, but I fear it may not be true, and that could have very, very bad consequences. In the article I wrote, I was exploring the idea that the advent of modern states and the sharp distinction between inside and outside, between a world of a domestic world of law and individual rights and an international world of realpolitik, meant that we were moral individualists in times of peace and moral relativists in times of war. That the rise of the modern state, which was very much associated with war making, again, another point that Robert Cooper makes clear in his article, involved a kind of social contract in which states obtained consent from people for fighting wars. They persuaded people to pay taxes and to risk their lives for the sake of the nation. And in exchange, citizens, at least in peacetime, got individual rights of various kinds, and as wars got more destructive and mobilized more people, so those rights were extended, reaching a high point in the Second World War when citizens obtained social and economic rights as well as civil and political rights. And what I argued was that this exchange involves a very sharp distinction between the soldier and the criminal. The soldier as the legitimate killer and the criminal as the illegitimate killer. And in wartime, the soldiers who fight, and the pilots who fly in planes are heroes, whereas an individual who kills is a criminal. And I think this, what I also argued was that this idea that in everything goes in wartime, although it was hedged in by the laws of war, led, and the nature of the war between states led to a kind of extremist tendency which reached its high point in World War II with the most hideous slaughter, not just the Holocaust, but the enormous scale of deaths in World War II is really almost impossible to comprehend. Now, in the current situation, I think we've reached a stage when those kinds of wars between states have become an anachronism, and I don't want to go into all the reasons why that is, but in the article I distinguished between two kinds of wars, both of which I think we're seeing today. One is the new wars, and I think that the attack of September the 11th was very much a new war, but it wasn't the first new war. It was perhaps more global and spectacular. It was more global and spectacular than ever before. And the other is what I call spectacle wars. And I will describe them very briefly in turn before reaching a conclusion. I think the big characteristics, there are three important characteristics of new wars. One is that new wars are fought not by states, but by networks. But these networks, and here I would disagree with John, they're not non-state actors. They're a combination of states and non-state actors. If you ask, for example, who undertook the massacres of Rwanda, yes, indeed, it was militias, Interahamwe, but militias armed by the state. And there's a curious, I add this as an aside in response to what John was saying, what you find in many of these killings is a curious division of labor between regular forces and irregular forces, in which irregular forces kill at a distance so that they can still act with impunity. They do Serbs, for instance, the Serb regular forces used artillery against the Kosovars, while it was the paramilitary groups who were sent in to commit atrocities and to undertake massacres. So all of these, and even Al-Qaeda, because after all the Taliban were part of the whole thing, involve a network of state and non-state actors. And undoubtedly, they flourish in weak or failing or collapsed states. And I think a key point about networks is that unlike the traditional hierarchical, vertical command structures of armies, networks can't be held together through a command system. And so the narrative becomes incredibly important. The ideology becomes incredibly important. And usually it's a very extreme moral relativist ideology, an ideology based on religion or ethnicity, and an ideology which is profoundly political. It's about the right to power on the basis of an exclusive ethnicity or religion. Now, a second characteristic of these new wars, which is very important, is the fact that instead of being wars in which you mobilize people to achieve military objectives, like capturing territory, the point of the violence is political mobilization. And in these cases, the point of the violence is to create the kind of fear and hatred which rallies people to the ideology or the narrative. Bosnia was an extreme case of this, where many people said this war had to be so bloody because we didn't hate each other before the war began. The point is to create fear and hatred, and the violence is directed against civilians. And I think September the 11th is a classic case of this kind of rationality. The third characteristic, which I won't go into, is the link with the criminal economy. I don't really want to talk about that now. But what I want to make clear is that the implications of these characteristics is that these are wars that are profoundly difficult to end. Because the power of the networks depends both on sustaining fear and hate. Their ideology depends on sustaining fear and hate. And also their economic sources. So there's a vested interest in continuing the war, and each bout of the war strengthens the networks. Instead of having a clear defeat or a clear victory, as was the case in old wars, each bout of war strengthens the hatred, the fear, and the networks. Now, what do I mean by spectacle wars? Well, spectacle wars are wars in which modern war has been reconstituted without casualties. And we've seen spectacle wars are typically wars fought by the air together with perhaps proxy forces. And we've seen spectacle wars in Yugoslavia, we saw it in the first Gulf War to some extent, and we are seeing it now in Afghanistan. And I call them spectacle wars because, again, the point is, I think, and here people may disagree with me, the point, the key point is satisfying public opinion. The key point is to show that you're doing something. In a sense, they're also a form of political mobilization. The actual military objective is less important than satisfying public opinion. And so it's also a form of political mobilization. Now, I take the view that this combination of spectacle wars and new wars is unbelievably dangerous. Because even though, and we can take the case of Afghanistan and we can be delighted that the Taliban has been defeated, nevertheless, I think what spectacle wars do is they create the kind of polarization which the networks need. Precisely because spectacle walls are casualty-free, at least casualty-free to the Western side, to the American side, they create the... They show, I mean, they don't create an illusion, it's a real fact, that Western lives are privileged over the lives of the people they're supposed to save. And that contributes to precisely the kind of distrust that led people to be attracted to the initial narrative. They create the kind of polarization that is precisely the opposite of what you want to achieve if you want to change the situation. So my view is that what's happened over the last few months, in which, in a sense, one has gone back to geopolitics, one's gone back to a kind of Cold War situation, although you have spectacle wars instead of virtual war, is going to create a kind of polarization in which it's going to be however many laws are passed against civilians to try to control terrorists, however much surveillance there is, it is going to be very, very difficult to create an alternative politics. And so that brings me back to the importance of values. It seems to me that the only way... I very much disagree with John about dirty hands, unless you mean by dirty hands that you have to risk people's lives, in which I do agree with you. But I think these are wars which can only be defeated through very, very clean hands. I think the only way to cope with these new wars is to undermine their narratives, and that means rebuilding, building an alternative legitimacy. And that's why global justice isn't just a nice thing that Tony Blair says in the Brighton speech. It's absolutely central to any kind of strategy for overcoming these kinds of wars. And it doesn't mean, by the way, that you don't engage in military action. I think terrorists have to be defeated. They're criminals. But I think you have to put it in a different way. I mentioned at the beginning the inside-outside distinction. If you like, the wars are bringing the outside inside. Our job has to be to bring the inside outside, to try to create, move towards an international rule of law. And defeating terrorists is part of enforcing that international rule of law. And that enforcement may well require military means, but it will require military means in which an Afghan civilian is valued more highly than an international soldier. An international soldier has to be seen like the firefighters and the policemen, people who are ready to risk their lives for the sake of humanity, for the sake of saving the lives of others. And that means you have to have people on the ground. You could have carried out the same operation. You would have risked Western lives, though not as many as the civilian lives that you lost, in my view, in Afghanistan. But you would have won a much greater moral victory. And such a military action, of course, has to be within a genuinely international framework. The attack of September the 11th should be regarded not as an attack on the United States, but as a crime against humanity. And in responding to crimes against humanity, one requires an international framework based on the kind of secular ideology that Joan described.
Okay, thank you very much. Robert?
Well, it's very difficult to speak after that because I think that I agreed with it, but I'm not quite sure. I need to think about some of it a little bit further. I just make one remark, and that is that if you're the difficulty with the thesis of let's have some casualties when we go to war is that it's quite difficult politically to sustain wars on that basis, and particularly to sustain wars that seem rather remote, that you're, when you're not obviously very directly under attack. So, well, maybe we'll get there at some point, but and after all, in peacekeeping, we take casualties and accept that, but probably only up to a certain limit. I'm going to start somewhere completely different. reflecting a little bit on what I wrote, which I wrote a long time ago. I think that the story that I want to tell is the story of liberty, equality, and fraternity, which seem to me to be the governing virtues of the order today. I think of globalization as being about the triumph of the market. It's up to you whether you like it or not. On the whole, I prefer the market to the military, which is the other alternative form of organization. I don't think that there's much in between. For all that one may dislike some of the manifestations of the market and the global market, it does bring with it certain values. Notably, it brings with it the values of liberty and equality. It's a strictly market view of the world that decides essentially that men and women are equal. It's a non-market, hierarchical, militarily oriented view of the world that decides that men are better than women, largely because of their superior capacity for violence. But the market evaluates people purely on the basis of how useful they are, which is not very uplifting, but it is the governing set of values that we have today. Anti-racism and feminism seem to me to be values derived from the market. The market needs some other values as well. It requires, in the end, it requires a degree of transparency and accountability. The problems of the so-called crony capitalism in some states in Asia, for example, show the weakness of systems which are not sufficiently transparent and open, and where personal ties dominate over market ties. So I won't go on at great length about this, but if you read the short things I wrote, you'll see what I mean when I say that I think today we live in a world in which the values of the market and the values of consumerism are, at least in the world that you here in LSE and me live in, these are the predominant values. And there is one big attraction of consumerism for me, and that is that it's one ideology that it's not worth getting killed for, because it's awfully difficult to consume after you've been killed. That's liberty and equality, and I'm going to come back in a second to fraternity, but I thought, because everyone else has talked about September the 11th, I would have a brief intermission about September the 11th. I thought September the 11th, it seemed to me, brought together three aspects of globalization. First, I think a part of globalization has been the end of empires. The world today is organized mostly by markets, whereas previously it used to be organized by empires. Again, empires essentially hierarchical military concept, markets, everybody is equal if you can make something better. So the end of empire, the end of the attractions of imperialism is what has left weak states like Afghanistan and Somalia, and has enabled the second aspect of globalization, transnational terrorism, to flourish, because it does need a base, and it does need a bit of help, as Mary has suggested, from not exactly a state, but something like a state. So that's the second aspect of globalization, is transnational terrorism. The third part of globalization, of course, is New York, which was really the capital of globalization, the capital of global markets. A city that, until September the 11th, took absolutely no notice of Washington. They were not interested in Washington. This was the place where the law that mattered in Wall Street, at any rate, was not so much U.S. law, it was international law. This was the headquarters of international companies. It was the World Trade Center, the headquarters of globalization. And on September the 11th, all of those three aspects of this new global era came together. A global era, a sort of an increasingly stateless era in the world. Statelessness in the Afghan sense, statelessness in the New York sense, and statelessness in terms of terrorism as well. And the reaction of the world to this has been essentially to bring back the state. That picks up perhaps what John Gray was saying. And you see it in New York and in the USA. You see it with the flags and the bumper stickers, the popularity of the president, the new attention being given to Washington. You see it at the United Nations, which is a kind of trade union of states. Sudden solidarity from all kinds of people who, China, Russia, the USA, not natural allies, but when they see the state itself threatened, then they realize a common interest. And of course you see it in Afghanistan, where the state is, I hope very much, being restored, being restored almost inevitably on the back of violence. Because the foundation of the state in some way is always about violence and the control of violence. Well, that was my intermission. I go back now quickly to liberty, equality, and fraternity to say the problem is fraternity. Liberty and equality, those are market values. Fraternity is a non-market value. Fraternity is about the idea of community, the connections that people feel to each other. I think when the slogan was used in the French Revolution, it was probably referring essentially to the national principle. The national principle which, like it or not, underlies our democratic organization. And the problem that we have is how do states, which are fraternal organizations based on some kind of feeling of community among the people, if the state's going to work, it needs something like that. How do those operate? How do territorial affinity-based states operate in a world without borders and in which so many things cross borders? And there are two answers to that. One of them is about regional organizations, and I'll leave that aside except to say that I think it's a hope that one can create a wider sense of community than national communities today. That in Europe, for example, I think that the common experience of the first half of the 20th century is one of the factors that has led to the creation of the European Union. And so out of that common experience, perhaps a wider community can be created. The second way in which territorially based states can operate across borders is in the way in which perhaps Mary hinted at, and that is they can get together with non-state actors. Now Mary quoted militia in Rwanda. I'd quote a different kind of non-state actor. The campaign against landmines struck me as an extremely effective partnership between a worldwide NGO and a state, in this case it was Canada. They couldn't have done it without them. British government is trying to do something a little bit the same over conflict diamonds, using an NGO, but nevertheless to get, we're using each other, I mean to get the NGO's agenda translated into international law, you need states to do that for you. So I see the state in Mary's terms, using the world of networks more, I see the state increasingly as one of a particular kind of actor in the network. It's a bad place to stop, but I've talked too long. So.
It certainly opens up a seam of discussion. Thank you very much. Okay, well, there's a huge amount there from the inevitability of conflict and therefore of wrong to secular ideology to the return of realpolitik and the non-state uses of old forms of state legitimacy. I hope that lots of people will want to participate, and I'll take questions or comments, if you can keep them fairly concise, in threes. And could you please tell us who you are before you ask your question or make your point? We'll start with you. Can you hang on for a microphone? Take your pick.
Just Khalid Miriam, student at Essex University. Just wanted to ask, Joan, you said the framework should be or must be based on secular values. Doesn't that exclude people whose values may indeed follow from some sort of, or have an a religious identity, exclude what I think Rawls called decent peoples? And Mary, I think your name is. Don't you think part of the problem is the reluctance to enforce international law when it comes to things like occupied Palestine or Kashmir, and an all too ready eagerness to enforce what the gentleman next to you called market values on us, on other people?
Thanks. In the front here, the second row, and then the third row.
My name is Jim Kennedy. A question for Dr. Cooper. Given that the theme of today's session is global morality, understandably you dealt with three essential concepts, liberty, equality, fraternité, in relation to the market economy. Would you not concur, Dr. Cooper, that there are other important values, some of which are subsumed under the morality rubric, which the market alone is not sufficient to determine?
They're just behind you. Yeah.
I'm Nicholas Maxwell, one of the contributors to this volume. It's the last one, so I thought I, if it's all right, try and summarize what I say in three sentences, four sentences, because I think it's important in what we're talking about. Really what I say is that if we're going to learn, if we're going to create a better world, so that we don't continue to do all the awful things that happened in the 20th century, in the next century, and so on, this century, we need to learn how to do it. Humanity needs to learn how to create a better world. And for that, it's necessary to have traditions and institutions well designed from the standpoint of helping. And the important thing to appreciate is we don't have a present. What we have, by and large, is a tradition of rational inquiry devoted to improving knowledge. Logical know-how. And that, from the standpoint of helping us to create a better world, to achieve what is of value in life for ourselves and others, is profoundly irrational. At the very least, rationality would involve, I mean, I think of rationality in general as strategies, methods designed to help solve our problems or achieve our aims. And two absolutely elementary is that we articulate our problems and propose and criticize possible solutions. A kind of inquiry rationally designed to help us achieve a better world, achieve what is of value in life, would give priority to the problems that we fundamentally need to solve, our problems of living, our problems of action, above all, how to resolve our conflicts in gradually, increasingly more cooperatively rational ways than we do at present. It would mean, in other words, that we would have a kind of inquiry that gives priority not to acquiring knowledge, but to propose to, first of all, articulating our problems of living and proposing possible solutions, possible acts, possible policies, philosophies of life, and so on.
And that's a beautiful
the
summary.
Of knowledge technology would be important, but secondary.
Thank you very much. Mary, do you want to start with a response to any of those?
Well, the question that was addressed to me, in which I have a lot of agreement, I think that if you are going to take legitimacy, global legitimacy, seriously, you can't have double standards. And this is precise. I mean, I didn't have time to go into it, but it seems to me what happened after September 11th was the creation of a kind of global state alliance on the Cold War model, which allowed everybody to dub
their enemies as terrorists, whether it was Israel and the Palestinians or Russia and Chechnya. And after all, one should not forget that what's going on in Chechnya is probably worse than anything that happened in Kosovo. I think thinking about what you noticed after September the 11th, for a brief moment, for a brief glorious moment, I thought these ideas of global justice might be taken up, and for a brief glorious moment, it looked as though Western governments were going to take seriously the Middle East question and start thinking about ways to solve it. But what you've seen over the last few months is more and more hardline support for Israel, which is exactly the opposite of what you want to do if you want to undermine the support for extremist Islam.
Robert.
This also enables me to apologize for the fact that when I've spoken, I'm going to go. I'm afraid I would much rather have stayed. This is the most interesting bit. Someone asked, does the market determine all values? Certainly not. There's a whole range of values that have nothing to do with the market: love, friendship, charity, courage. These are values which are connected to the community and the state. These are the values, in a way, of fraternity rather than liberty and equality. And the problem is that you can't have the liberty and equality unless you have the state. At least we haven't found a way. Maybe we can. That requires this whole range of other values, which are, to my mind, they're much more traditional. They're much more connected to military, to the military world, or to worlds of communities. And communities are, in some sense, based, if not on irrational, at least on non-rational principles, on things like family relationships, which has nothing to do with reason. Market relationships are essentially reason, essentially reasonable. Yes, they are. This is exactly the problem. And this, by the way, is why it's quite wrong for the Financial Times to accuse the backers of Huntington Life Sciences of cowardice. This doesn't enter into the realm of what markets are about. Companies are not about courage, they're about profit. Whereas governments ought to be about courage and not about profit.
Good. I'll just interrupt the flow there as Robert leaves to ask if you can thank him both for making the effort to come and also for his contribution.
Joan.
Well, the question to me was whether secular morality excludes people of religious faith, and I think it actually does the opposite, because what I'm talking about here is democracies whose basis is a set of secular values, which of course includes freedom of conscience, and that gives individuals the freedom to have a religious faith or no faith at all. But I think the important distinction I would draw is that religion in those kind of societies has to be a matter of private conscience and not of public policy, which is why I'm opposed to faith schools. Because I don't want Christian schools or Islamic schools any more than I want atheist schools or Republican schools or feminist schools. I mean, I happen to agree with all those three ideologies, and that's how I describe myself, but I don't want children indoctrinated in that. And I think the purpose of education is to give children choice. I'm very happy for them to go to schools where they learn about lots of different religious faiths. They also learn about agnostic positions and people who have no faith at all. So I think, on the contrary, I think secular morality actually allows people to make individual choices about their faith. It doesn't exclude it at all.
John.
Well, I just make two comments in response to the discussion so far. I do think that secular humanism can exclude ways of life and civilizations. I do think it can. And I think it partly can because it is a religion. I mean, I'm not myself a religious believer, but I'm not a secular humanist either, because I treat secular humanism as simply a religion whose principal roots, actually, like those of the Enlightenment generally, are in Christianity. And since I'm not a Christian, I'm not an Enlightenment believer either. But the way I think it does exclude people is that essentially there's behind it is a monistic idea. It's the idea of the world being unified by a single civilization animated by a single set of values. That's, I think, the idea of humanism, and it's a noble idea in many ways. It's led to great benefits for many people, diminished injustice in the world, but I think it's essentially dangerous and delusive. And instead of focusing on that, I think this time we thought about something a little more modest, but also more promising, which is peace, coexistence, peaceful coexistence between different cultures, different ways of life, and different civilizations. And that's not to say that I think of civilizations as fixed things, monads. All civilizations are open, all civilizations are conflicted, but they're also different. There are different forms of thought, different forms of practice in the world. So, and people do have different identities. I take that to be part of the human animal. In other words, I'm a naturalist, not a humanist. I take religion to, where does it come from? Satan? It comes from human beings. This terrible thing, religion, is a very profoundly, deeply rooted human need, it seems. Often manifests strongest in opponents of religion, actually. So I think we should simply take that as a given and take that as the background of our thought, and then think, how can this world in which humans seem to divide themselves by different identities as naturally as they speak different languages, we're not all born speaking Esperanto, how can such a world be more peaceful? How can it be more cooperative? How can it be less afflicted by genocide and new and old types of war? And if we think of it in those ways, I think we'll give up the idea, or at least severely modify and make more minimal and modest the idea of a universal civilization. What we'll think of instead is of certain common rules and procedures within which practitioners of different ways of life and different civilizations can get on together and benefit from each other's presence in the world.
Thanks. More questions, right in the back.
Thank you. Yes, my name's Joseph Najjar. Basically, I think what September the 11th has taught us is that people all around the world, not just in the Middle East, are bypassing their governments and have actually lost faith in their ability to influence their lives. And that includes also international institutions like the United Nations and the Geneva Convention. I say this particularly because of Israel. Now, Israel, in its 34 years of occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, has actually breached the Geneva Convention. Every single act of the Geneva Convention is breached, bar one, that's slavery. That's 12,500 days. It's incumbent on high contracting parties of the Geneva Convention to enforce respect for the Geneva Convention, and nobody has enforced it. It's the same with the United Nations. Israel has refused to comply with any resolution of the United Nations, and people all over the Middle East see this as double standards, and they think, well, our governments aren't doing anything, nobody's doing anything, all this highfalutin words from the West is a load of rubbish, so we have to take things into our own hands, and it's very, very dangerous. And as I said, it's not just the Middle East. You have it over here as well with the anti-globalizations. Governments refuse to listen. And that's why we're having a breakdown. Thank you.
Thanks very much. There? Thanks. Is there anyone upstairs? Yeah, I'll come.
Marilyn Mason, I work for the British Humanist Association. And this is just a quick comment. I just want to defend humanism from the charge that it's a religion. Thank you.
Thank you. Can we go up to the balcony in the middle with the yellow tie and then at the front?
Christopher Bostrom, London School of Economics. There would seem to be an appreciable conflict between an international moral order and the postmodern project of continual self-reinvention, and where absolute immutable principles are difficult to maintain. I'm wondering how we can reconcile that seemingly contradictory goals in this globalized society.
Thank you. And a small challenge for 20 minutes remaining. Can we go to the front row on the balcony? Sorry. And just have one more.
Hi, my name is Isaac. I'm at LSE as well. In the new secular morality, the notion of human rights plays a very important role. However, the basis for establishing human rights in the new secular morality seems rather shaky. Previously, human beings had rights because of their unique and special relationship to God. It is that relationship which establishes morality. If we no longer accept this relationship, then on what basis do we say human beings have rights? Simply announcing that human beings have rights is not good enough, because after all, animals have rights too.
Thank you. Should we go the other way and start with John this time?
I'm sympathetic to that last question, as could be imagined. I think it's no easy matter, actually, to say what the foundations of rights are or which rights we have. I mean, I think there can be common agreement among a very wide range of people, not only secular humanists, but way beyond that, way beyond secular humanists, on what certain deep, profound violations of human rights are, genocide, torture, certain types of war. But once we get beyond that, those clear points of extremity, I don't think we do find that there is consensus on what human rights are. And even where there is, we find that one right can conflict with another. For example, most European countries have, to my mind rightly, got laws against racist speech and expression. That curbs the right of free speech. The United States, and I think within Europe, Denmark, I may be corrected on that, doesn't have such laws because they regard such laws as curbing a more fundamental right. Here we have a clash of rights. How do we resolve this? It seems to me that there's no book written in the heavens or in the heart of men or women which tells us how to do so. We have to actually appeal back beyond rights to conceptions of the good society. We have to look at those conceptions and we'll find that they contain conflicting ingredients, and we'll also find that different people had different conceptions. So the only way, it seems to me, is the long haul of politics. The only way is the long haul of dealing with each other in some kind of democratic political context. And it's that, it seems to me, that should have priority over very ambitious declarations of human rights, particularly at a time, let me just make one further comment on September the 11th. September the 11th was like a bolt of lightning. A bolt of lightning reveals a stilled landscape, but it's a landscape which was no different before the bolt. What it reveals is what was there already. So what was there already were weak states. What was there already were profound conflicts in the Middle East and elsewhere. What was there was the fact that freedom of capital and trade was not combined and will not be combined with freedom of movement across the world of people. Before September the 11th, the leading point of conflict in politics in all European countries, including Britain, was around asylum seekers and refugees. In other words, it was globalization bursting at the seams. People were trying to move away from collapsed states and war zones into peaceful zones where there were states and they were being stopped. That was before September the 11th. September the 11th, no doubt, has many consequences and implications, but its chief one, its chief significance, is revealed what the world was actually like. It forced us upon our attention the kind of conflicts and contradictions within globalization that were already there. So I don't think there's been any actually big change. Here, I think I may disagree with Mary a little bit. I don't think there's been any big change. I don't think the world before September the 11th was a world in which transnational institutions had any particular significance or authority or power. That wasn't given to them by sovereign states. That was true then. It's even more true now. It's not more true. It's simply more visibly true. So I suppose I'm making, as it were, a plea here for looking at the world in all of its ambiguities, contradictions, and paradoxes. And I think there is a difference between the view I'm putting forward, which aims for modus vivendi and coexistence, not for a universal civilization or universal values, because I think every attempt to construct them ends up leading, by some peculiar and curious paradox, excluding the majority of the human species.
Thanks. Joan.
Well, I certainly think that secular humanism is more honest, and that's one of the ways in which it is an improvement on religion in that it admits that that these conflicts, and it doesn't pretend to any kind of divine authority, and it says that we do actually have to argue these things out. I don't have as many problems with John as coming up with universal values, because I think the people who drew up the Universal Declaration of Rights after the Second World War made a pretty good stab at it. And I think what his analysis ignores is that if we can't come to some kind of agreement on democratic values and values like freedom of conscience, what we end up is with civilizations which are coercive and oppressive to certain types of people. As a feminist, the role of women obviously concerns me a great deal in those kind of societies. But also, I think it ignores the fact that religions give rise to precisely the kind of conflicts that he was saying we should acknowledge at the beginning of his talk, because religions are proselytizing and they are in conflict with each other and they're in competition for members. And so I don't think it's as simple as he suggests. On the question of September the 11th, I think what's very interesting about September the 11th is the way in which the Americans have managed to lose the high ground, moral high ground, actually quite quickly. So I think there was a period of about 4 weeks after the attacks when it looked as if they might be prepared to use international mechanisms like the UN, might be thinking in terms of some kind of international tribunal to try Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda terrorists, and have some kind of concerted international action. And what we've seen since then is essentially a unilateralist action, a return to American unilateralist action of the kind that we've seen before, with Tony Blair providing a kind of fig leaf of respectability and a few bombs and soldiers. I think that's fantastically depressing, because what I would have liked, I was writing about the Taliban from 1996 onwards, at a time when people were not very interested in them at all, and it was always clear that the Taliban was not an indigenous organization, or indeed an organization that could sustain itself without support from Pakistan. And every year, the Congressional Reports on Terrorism actually said that, and described in great detail how Pakistan was creating and supporting the Taliban and the kind of abuses that human rights abuses that the Taliban were involved in. And it was also clear, and it's now clear because of the pressure that the Americans put on Pakistan, how quickly they could have been forced to withdraw that support, and there could have been another way of dealing with the Taliban. And it does seem to me rather obscene that we only dealt with the Americans only got tough with the Taliban when Americans started being killed, even though we know that massive human rights abuses were going on in Afghanistan for 5 years before that.
Mary.
Well, I agree with John that what we need is politics. And I think that in the period between 1989 and September the 11th, we were moving away from a world dominated by war and preparations of war to a world dominated by politics. And that was the very positive aspect of the post-Cold War period. And although September the 11th didn't change everything immediately, although it showed that the world as it was on September the 10th, I think that the Bush administration, through the unilateralism which Joan is describing, is bringing us back from politics towards a world dominated by military considerations. Second point, I think politics requires certain fundamental human principles. I don't think you can have politics unless you agree on certain rules of the game. And one of the rules of the game is that you don't coerce people, that you don't use physical violence. And that, I think, is a fundamental human principle. Third point about universalism, John said, universal projects end up with terrible consequences, and I do agree with you. I mean, if we look at so many utopian projects have turned into totalitarianism. But I think there's also a problem about not having utopian projects. I think human societies need utopian projects if they're to be inclusive and not exclusive, if they're to respect human principles, if they're, and the question is, can we find a way, a middle way between these harsh, exclusive utopias and the kind of utopias which allow us to live our lives? And that finally leads me to the point about humanism. I call myself a cosmopolitan, and one of the reasons is that I think that combines the idea of multiculturalism and respect for difference with humanistic principles. So I like to put the two in. And I think there are cases, although I am secular. You know, I can see some very muscular secularism, particularly in the Middle East, where, you know, politics is caught between the secularism of authoritarian nationalists and the extremism of Islam. But I was very struck. This is the second of these Demos meetings, and Amartya Sen said quite rightly, well, why is cultural identity so important? I have lots of identities. Why do we put that as a priority? And the question there was a big discussion about faith-based schools, and I went away saying, well, what about class-based schools? why do we think class-based schools are all right and not faith-based schools? Because that's basically what we have in this country. Yep. And so I think, you know, if I think about 30 years ago, we were much more preoccupied with our identities as members of a class than we were as our identities as members of a culture. And I think one of the problems with the emphasis on whether it's conflict or coexistence is that it elevates cultural identity above other kinds of identities, which are also very important, whether they're class, whether they're gender, whether they're profession. And I want to see a world which respects all kinds of differences, not just cultural differences.
Okay. More questions? I think I can see a hand right at the back at the top.
Yes, my name is Josie Appleton from Spiked Online. One thing I noticed about this debate is there is almost a very abstract talking about ideal principles, which seems quite far from the ground. So I had a couple of questions, I think. When we're talking about someone like Tony Blair pursuing a global morality, firstly, is that kind of global morality, can we see that being strong in the West? I mean, for example, if you look at democracy and rationality, I mean, we have a government, you know, which employs kind of, you know, which negates parliament. We have a population which doesn't bother to vote. In terms of rationality, we don't have a strong secular humanist tradition here. You know, mysticism is rampant. So firstly, you know, are these values strong in the West? Secondly, even if they were, could you simply impose them upon other societies? You know, if you impose democracy upon a society, don't you end up choosing leaders for the country, which in the end isn't democracy? And we've seen some of the problems with imposing women's equality upon Afghanistan. You know, does that make sense in the context of a Pashtun rural society?
It's really mostly a question to Mary. I was quite interested in what you had to say about new wars not being linked to territory, because I think the example you used was the Balkan Wars, which largely ended up being about largely about refugees and return and where people live and therefore territory. But I think I'm not quite sure how you apply it there, but I see that it might well apply very well to the current situation, because Bin Laden doesn't have territorial demands. It's not quite clear what he wants, but it's not territory in the traditional sense. The second question I have is about how quite quickly you can ensure that significant numbers of people in Arab and Muslim countries feel that the values that you're talking about apply to them in a very practical sense, so that the ideology that Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda are propagating don't appeal. That's the immediate demand that politicians face, and I wonder what you think can be done to ensure that that happens.
Any more? Yeah, no, go for it. And then we'll go up to the back.
My question's for the same panelist. My name is Barrett Bradstreet. I'm a student also. And my question is on the concept of spectacle wars, which was brought up earlier. And I think it's an intriguing concept, but I hope you might address one particular objection, I suppose. And it seems to me the concept defined, as you define it, is one where military objectives are subsumed to political objectives. My critique is, it seems to me that that's par for the course for military action generally. And it seems to me that sort of warfare, by definition, is the pursuit of policy objectives by means of military force. And it seems to me that the proper state of affairs is one where violent action is taken not for sort of random purposes or for the purposes of strict military purposes like destruction, but one where specific policy guides the application of force. And it seems to me that if we accept that definition of warfare, this idea of spectacle war is maybe new in the particular policies pursued, but not in the fact that policy precedes the pursuit of military objectives. And I hope you just might address that.
Thank you. I'm going to take one more because I'm then going to ask the speakers to answer some of those specific questions and also make any closing comments. So there was, a question right at the back.
Yeah, a couple of points for John Gray. Firstly, on the supposed irrelevance of transnational institutions, having worked extensively in the international community, I think it's too early to write off a lot of what's being done on the ground in pursuit of human rights objectives. On the basis of political fact, it's not actually correct to dismiss initiatives in the transition region. The European IDEA, a major transnational project in Europe, is actually bringing progress to parts of the Balkans. It may be patchy and it may be inconsistent, but there is real progress. Similarly, the work by international organizations on the ground, for example, in Central Asia, may possibly lead to gains for democracy in the next few years. They may be small, but this is probably the only way forward for many of those states. Secondly, on the universality of human rights standards, having worked with commitments on the ground in a lot of different social contexts, there very often is something which is applicable and does reach out to people, not as an imposition, but as something which is enabling and empowering. I think it's a pity that very often the wrong conventions have been stressed, and some of the conventions which put social justice and equality ahead of the freedoms such as contained in the ICCPR are perhaps more relevant. So we may hope to see more emphasis on conventions like CEDAW and conventions on social and economic rights in the future. And just once again to point out and say that such standards are universal to the extent that they've been negotiated in great detail, often by civil societies as well as governments, so they do reflect a real consensus.
Thank you. John, should we start with you?
Yeah, I'll try to make a few. Obviously, we've had a very wide-ranging discussion, which has gone from the intellectual history of modern Europe to, indeed, not just modern Europe, but the whole world, through to September the 11th and beyond. So it's hard to know what to respond to, but I'll try and limit myself to two or three brief remarks. On transnational organizations, I don't want to say that they're pointless or worthless, but the fact of the matter seems to me to be, and has been from 1989 up to September the 11th, and will be in any future that we can realistically conceive, that they are dependent on sovereign states and that their opportunities for action are granted by sovereign states. For example, I've no doubt that admirable work is being done by transnational institutions in the Balkans and elsewhere. But it remains the case, it seems to me, that the Balkan War, the war in Kosovo, whatever view you take of it, would not have been waged by the Europeans alone. It would not have been waged or brought to the conclusion to which it was brought unless the United States entered with its policies and its military and strategic and logistical and technological power. That just seems to be a fact. And I think it's sobering, it's chastening, it's useful to remind oneself of these facts, because these facts are the facts which more than any other facts will determine the shape of the world that you will all live in and that I will live in. We can humanize them, we can hope to improve them, and I hope we can, but we have to recognize. And this leads me on to the second point, which is a sort of global framework for dealing with terrorism. I want to see one set up. I favor that. I favor the resistance to terrorism. But let me make another point. In actual fact, the framework which has to some extent been set up is a framework constructed among flawed states, and I don't exclude our states. I don't say that our states are without flaws. the states that belong to this are all, to some or other degree or in different ways, deeply flawed. China, Iran, the United States, Britain, they're all involved, one way or the other, in deep conflicts. They've all committed massive human rights violations. They're all continuing to be involved in various types of serious rights violation. That seems to me to be simply part of the territory of this. To imagine that we can escape from it, the period from 1989 to September the 11th was simply a period of mass self-delusion. What ended then with that atrocity was at least actually part of the self-deception. So we can maybe now start thinking more realistically about what's possible. It was also a period, by the way, of great wars. The Gulf War occurred during that period. The terrible war in Chechnya, as Mary has pointed out, occurred in that period. The Balkan War occurred in that period. It was not a period of peace. It was a period of great human suffering. My final remark, you might say, well, what kind of way forward could one take from this? Well, let me just throw out one thought. A less highly globalized world might in some ways be safer. A world in which the World Bank and the IMF did not insist on every single state in the world conforming to a few eccentric practices and norms derived from an abstract model of Western market economies. Let different countries have different rules, different practices. People will say this is protectionism. What of it? It exists anyway. Why not be open about it? And I think that would involve greater tolerance of diversity, even in fairly fundamental matters, even in matters which some people regard as absolutely core issues of human rights. Now, you might think that's intolerable, but what I'm thinking of at the moment is a more peaceful world. You might think that's a rather grubby, shabby, petty goal, but when the stakes are as high as they are now, not of global thermonuclear war, but of very serious conflicts involving great damage to human beings, I think peace is an important consideration. Coexistence is an important value. To that extent, I would like to see what hasn't been done at all, except by a few people, a few Greens have thought about it, which is to think of not of a world relocalized, that's impossible, not of another utopia, Rousseau-esque world in which we have nothing to do with each other, but just of how we could actually get to a world in which the relentless pressure of globalization is somewhat abated and mitigated so that we can have a constructive degree in some contexts and in some areas of deglobalization.
Thanks. Joe?
I think on the point about Tony Blair, I think that he has now realized that these international crusades don't play very well here when he's already won a second term and hasn't dealt with really pressing questions like poverty and the way in which poverty feeds into racism in this country. If he isn't prepared to deal with redistribution of wealth here, then inevitably he's going to make the kind of conflicts which his morality would actually outlaw even more likely. But I think on the larger question, I think what I would like to say is that I think since September the 11th we've seen something which is very frightening. There's an account of what happened in the White House war room on September the 12th when the American president and his main advisors gathered to decide their response to September the 11th. And the person who made the big pitch and was listened to was George Tenet, who is the head of the CIA, the director of the CIA. You would think a man who was actually in a state of some embarrassment since he is obsessed with Osama bin Laden and had completely failed to predict that these attacks were going to happen in any form. But what he said was that they had to be a unilateral American action which would involve very traditional means of dealing with the problem, which is high-level bombing, use of proxies on the ground, and so on, that America would run it. And the most chilling thing that he said to the president was, we have a 60-country problem. And what George Bush said in his State of the Union speech today, earlier this week, seems to confirm that the Americans now see themselves not in a state of permanent revolution, which was Trotsky's phrase, but in a state of permanent war. And they seem to be trying to prosecute that war according to their own very narrow morality and their own very narrow interests, and disregarding the international community. And that's what I think is very dangerous, and why I think that the rest of us need to think very hard about the kind of values that we share and that we want to support in opposition to that.
Thanks. Mary.
Okay. Well, first, just very briefly on human rights are their Western construct. I mean, obviously they have their origin in the Western Enlightenment, which we've talked so much about this evening. But what always strikes me is that the so-called rights revolution that became so important in the 70s and 80s began not in the West, but in Latin America and Eastern Europe. And it seems to me the most vigorous proponents of human rights are those people in areas of the world that are suffering from the abuse of human rights. And were we in the West really trying to impose human rights on the rest of the world, I think we would do a much better job of it than we do. It seems to me that we're rather bad at it, and we're not very committed. Robert Cooper, and I forgot to reply to him, said, oh, but nobody's ever going to be prepared to risk casualty. I wasn't, by the way, proposing big risks of casualties. Nevertheless, we're not prepared to even risk casualties, and we want to rely on people like the Northern Alliance. Seems to me to show that we don't take human rights very seriously. Now, on this question of territory and the politics of war, I think what happens in the new wars is, in old wars, what you did was you took territory militarily. You sent in your army and tried to capture territory militarily. What happens in places like the Balkans is the strategy is to control territory politically. So you don't try to win the territory through a military victory. What you really want to do is, in the case of the Balkans, you want to win elections, and the best way to win elections is to do it by having an ethnically clean territory. So you want to expel everybody else, and you want to create the fear and hatred so the others don't want to live there. And the point of the violence is not to catch the territory, but to get rid of everybody who won't support you, and to create a situation of terror in which you can maintain political power. And I actually am sure that Al-Qaeda also has political goals of that kind. So it may be concerned about territory. I mean, certainly in their kind of statement, they talk about creating a Muslim caliphate over the whole of the Middle East. So perhaps they do want Middle Eastern territory, but their aim is to catch it politically. The point of the violence is to gain people to their cause. And that's where I was making the same parallel with spectacle wars. In old wars, you did, as Clausewitz said, the idea was to compel an opponent to fulfill your will. And the opponent was another state, and you did it by catching his territory. Here, there's a political goal, but the political goal is not, the military is not to catch territory militarily. The political goal is to keep your public opinion happy. And so the point of the spectacle, there may be a military objective, because you need to show you've got a policy objective, but the point is politics, if you like, rather than policy. Then there was a question, well, what do you do? How do you undermine these narratives? And I think that's what this whole discussion is about, and the lady up there talked about what was happening in Central Asia and the Balkans. I think there's a big job to be done. The one thing I would emphasize is that in all the war zones, you do find human rights groups, you do find peace groups, you do find civil society groups, and those groups need protection, they need support, and where you have a certain degree of freedom, which means that the extremists are less able to use coercive methods, you usually find those civil society groups expand and gain more support. And I could go on at great length about the kinds of things you could do, but I think the key point is supporting the local human rights and democrats in these war zones. Finally, globalization. And John said, well, it would be nice to have a little bit of deglobalization. I think it would be nice to have a little bit of deglobalization, although the experience of 20th century deglobalization has been profoundly dangerous. And I think the one thing that is very good about deglobalization is that old wars, wars between states, which were even more destructive and horrific than the new wars that we're facing now, are over. And my fear about deglobalization is that the only way you could achieve it would be going back to old wars. What I think is the only way is to humanize globalization, and humanizing globalization would mean that the World Bank and the IMF could not dictate standard artificial recipes, that there would be much greater respect for the wishes of people at a local level. That seems to me to be the only way forward.
Hmm. Okay, I'm not even going to attempt to sum up. If you're a guest of the speakers and you're joining us for a drink upstairs and you need some directions, then please can you talk to a Demos person or an LSE person outside. And I'm genuinely sorry that we can't invite you all this time. I think that many of the strands of this discussion will continue and I hope deepen over the year to come and probably many other years. But in the meantime, thank you very much for coming, and thank you in particular to our speakers.
Yeah.